The next part of the notes, I've just put in a bit about consciousness, just so that we're clear. In talking about the mind, you know, what mind is. So, consciousness or mind, that they are synonyms, is simply the subjective awareness of things. Right? We are aware of things through our five senses, our eyes, ears, nose, tongue and touch, and through our what we call mental consciousness, our thoughts and ideas, our knowledge, our memories. All of these are associated not with the sense awareness, but with what in Buddhism we call mental consciousness or mental awareness. So mind, in other words, being merely the experience of things, the subjective experience of things, which has associated feelings of happiness, unhappiness, emotions, positive emotions, destructive emotions, and so on. These are all mind. There is clearly an interdependent relationship with consciousness or mind and the brain, the nervous system, and the whole body. I've been reading recently, they talk about our gut as being the second brain, because they're beginning to realize that events happening in our alimentary system are strongly associated with mental states. So there's an interdependent, which means that the brain, the nervous system, the glands which secrete hormones which are related to different mental states, then there's a relationship between that and the mind. The mind is dependent upon the physical body, which includes everything, and the physical body is dependent upon the mind. So this is contrary to the prevailing belief in science that consciousness is produced by the nervous system and the sensory organs. It's a result, it's created. And mind, therefore, is necessarily a physical phenomenon. That is the prevailing view in science, medicine. But Buddhism is not exactly like that. Of course, mental states are related to the functioning of the body, with the hormones and the nervous system. You can't have consciousness if you don't have a functioning brain, nervous system, and so on. But it's not created. Mind awareness is simply being aware. Right? Our awareness of each other, our awareness of the room, the outside environment, that very awareness is consciousness. Mediated through the eyes, ears, the organs, and the brain, but not the same. Being a non-physical entity, consciousness cannot be created by the physical entity of our body. Whatever the body gives rise to is necessarily physical. Right? So, this is very important, presentation of consciousness or mind as being an active phenomenon. It's not passive by any means. In fact, when the mind is trained, when we gain greater powers of concentration, wisdom, compassion, and so on, the mind exhibits its dominant role. One example, Lama Tupin Yeshi, our first teacher, he as a child, he had rheumatic fever and the valves in his heart were severely affected as a young boy, and for the rest of his life, he had a struggle with the functioning of the valves in his heart. And he was progressively reaching a point of unable to cope with the strictures of the valves and so on. Whenever Lameshi went to a Western doctor or medical facility, faculty, they all said, you've got to have a valve replacement. You can't go on like this. And at one time, I took him to an Indian hospital in Dharamsala, in northern India, because he was seeking a visa to come to Australia, and he had to have a medical certificate just to get a tourist visa. And the Indian doctors were equally astonished, because by that time, Lameshi's heart was massively enlarged because of the extra work it had to do. And the Indian doctors said this, and when they left the room, Lameshi smiled at me. He said, they all say this, but they don't know the power of the mind. And he had checked with his teachers whether to have a heart valve replacement or not, and they said it wouldn't help. So he didn't. Later, a few years later, when he did go into heart failure, he was taken from Nepal to India and to the United States, and they did all of the angiograms and so on. And what astonished the doctors was that in Lameshi's heart, there was a completely different artery. Like the arteries which feed the heart muscle itself are well known and well labelled. But the left ventricles that were so massively enlarged, and normally the blood vessels in the heart they don't grow. Once you reach the limit, that's it. You have your heart attack or whatever. But there was a totally abnormal artery, large, feeding this massively enlarged left ventricle. And to me, I thought, this must be the power of the mind. You know, over the years, through the power of Lameshi's mind, I can't say it's a conscious thing, I will make these arteries bigger, but it happened. And it was considered. That's why he lived so long, because his heart was able to maintain its own blood supply when normal hearts would have outgrown their blood supply and just stopped. So I put this forward as a possible explanation of the power of the mind over the body. And when you look, like everything that human society has come up with, the most incredible engineering feats, artistic feats, what we've done, that has all come from the mind. The power of being able to conceptualize something entirely new or something engineeringly impossible, apparently impossible, but to get around it, to send rockets to the moon and so on. This all comes from the mind. It doesn't come from the brain. The brain is a necessary support, of course, for thinking and mental activity. But it's not the source of the incredible things that the human mind has been able to do through the ages. So this, you have to go and check out. What is your mind? So, very simply, it is subjective awareness of things. Now, awareness can be correct or incorrect according to whether things exist or not in the way they're apprehended. And many, even our senses can be tricked, by mirage or echoes. And there are many environmental things which appear to be like a person on the other side of the valley echoing our voice, but that's not true. A mirage looking like water in the desert, it appears as water. And some people can think it's water, but that's mistaken perception. Then, each person's mind is simply a continuum of constantly changing awareness through our senses, through our thoughts and ideas. And this, as this continuum of awareness, which is mind, cannot be created from the brain. It can't come from nowhere. I mean, you can't have an effect or a result arising without a cause. Nothing can come from nothing. So there has to be a cause for our present consciousness, our present mind. It can't have come from our parents' minds, because otherwise we would be born with the knowledge and the memories, the attitudes of our parents. But we're not. Each baby has its own mind already. It has to come from a past life. It exists. It's not from the body. It's not from the parents. It must be a continuum of past consciousness. And where was that consciousness? In a past life. And when we die, similarly, as the body dies, the consciousness survives death and goes into a future life. So, that's mind. Awareness, sensory, or mental. In mental awareness, for most of us, our mental consciousness is involved in ideas or concepts, conceptual awareness. So we're thinking, we've got knowledge, and we're thinking about things, like the knowledge, the first level of wisdom, knowledge, is conceptual. It's things we've learned, facts that we've learned and stories we've heard. And when we learn a fact, our mental consciousness creates a mental image. We have an idea of what we've learned. There is this, with the, as we reflect upon what we learned, our mind creates a mental idea, a mental picture of what we learn. So you see, intellectual awareness based upon just knowledge is very much an inner world of mental imagery, where we establish mental images of what we've learned. Then the second level of wisdom, the understanding through logical reasoning, is still imagery. Now, the problem with this is that we think the objects of our knowledge are what we think they are. In other words, we confuse our idea of something, our idea of a piece of knowledge, with our inner picture of the object of knowledge. So you see, there is an element of confusion there, where we mistake the actual thing for our idea of it. Even a correct understanding established through logical reasoning still has an element of mistake, in that we think we know what we're talking about. We have this inner subjective idea. That's why we need to proceed to the third level, wisdom, born out of perfect single-pointed concentration, where our mind, our subjective awareness, penetrates our idea of what something is and knows the reality without subjective distortion. That is wisdom. There's no longer any basis for mistake. It is correct knowledge, and then we remove that element of error from the intellectual understanding. I mean, in science, subjective beliefs or so are the most bad, worst thing possible. They will contaminate any scientific theory. It's got to be objective. And there's always the great search for subjective interpretation of the results of experiments and so on. Quite correctly, eliminating a degree of error, subjective superimposition or subjective interpretation upon the results. So objective reality is of great importance. But very few scientists reach the level of wisdom, if any, of that clear non-conceptual, you see in the list there's non-conceptual direct awareness. Non-conceptual means the mind goes beyond the intellectual understanding and has direct awareness, free from subjective influence. That is wisdom. That is the clear wisdom which we need to develop. Now, each moment of awareness has two aspects. Whenever we're aware of anything, this is now looking into consciousness itself. I'm conscious of something. So what's happening when I'm conscious of the red cloth? So when the eyes perceive red colour, then there's the direct appearance of redness. There is in the awareness, there is red. And we know to call that red because we've learnt that in the past. But the eye consciousness does not label the cloth red. What happens when we have a sensory experience, that information is then transferred to the mental consciousness, the thinking aspect of mind. And so it's the mental consciousness which then knows that this colour is suitable to be called red, and which applies the label red. So you see, simply the simple visual consciousness of a colour has these two steps: the pure sensory impression and then the mental labelling of red upon the object. So this clear appearance to the senses, whether it's sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, or a tangible object, there's just that basic sensory experience, and then mental consciousness will interpret or label. So that's clear appearance. And then the second aspect of consciousness or awareness, at the same time as the object is appearing, there is knowing or cognitive engagement in the appearing object. So red colour is the appearing object directly to the eye consciousness. The eye consciousness knows what is appearing. It doesn't label it red, but it is aware of the appearance of that colour. Then the information goes to the mental consciousness. And what mental consciousness does, what appears is then our knowledge of red. We know that this appearance to the eyes is suitable to be called red. And we can actually close our eyes and still there's the appearance of the red cloth, not to eye consciousness, but to mental consciousness. And then the mental consciousness, it does many things. First, it can give a label, red. Then it might like red or dislike red. So it is good colour or bad colour. Or the mental consciousness might be miserable because there's been an argument at home. And so there is an attitude from mental consciousness which influences our conceptual awareness of the colour. I don't care about it, or, there are all sorts of subjective distortions and changes and attitudes which influence our sensory awareness of the world. You know, music, we may hear music, we don't know anything about a composition or, you know, music itself, the science of music, but it might be pleasing, it might be displeasing. But somebody who has knowledge then has about music and composers and so on and the dates and times and can have a vastly different mental consciousness experience of music. And again, our emotional state. We might associate music with a time when we're in love with somebody, and so that is so special because that music brings to mind the situation, a very happy situation in the past. So you see, this is why our minds are so different and changing, but they have their own way of functioning, which is dependent on brain and nervous system, but it's never the same, and it can change. Somebody who knows nothing about music can study composition and types of music and also the different instruments which are being played. They can know so much about the, you know, an orchestra's music and which instruments carrying tunes, etc., etc. So we can learn that from knowing nothing about music. We can learn so much. And then the experience of the same music is so different, dependent upon the mind. Yes, the memory imprints, the knowledge imprints, depend upon a functioning brain. If those bits of our cortex are knocked out by a stroke or something, then we can't remember the names. There are certain aspects of our experience where we lose the capacity to distinguish the different parts of sensory experience or even thoughts. But that is only because I hate to use this analogy of brains and computers, but the hardware is damaged, but the software is not. So even, you know, as we grow older and we lose our memory and our cognitive awareness gets worse and worse and worse, that is due to the hardware, the brain. The mind does not grow old. Mind doesn't age at all. Of course it experiences past, present, future, but it doesn't have the degenerative qualities of physical aging in the brain. But it can't express itself because it no longer has the physical capacity to remember words, to express words and so on, but the cognitive faculty of mind itself does not degenerate. So, that's just talking about mind. Now, the important subject is persons. I'm a person, you're a person, we're all persons. In Buddhism, animals are persons, spiders are persons. A person doesn't strictly refer to human beings. Anything with mind is a person. A Buddha is a person with mind. So, the person or the individual, then each person is merely labelled, or the mere name given to a particular functioning combination of body and mind. Right? So, functioning combination of body and mind. We've got to see this duality of consciousness and the body functioning together, interdependently functioning together. So where you have that, as in a baby, then a newborn baby, then the first thing to think, what will we call it? So we give the baby a name. And from then on, we always refer to that baby or that person through its name. And everybody asks, oh, what's its name? Or his or her name. And so they learn the name. And when, now, that's okay. Whatever exists is merely labeled. But the problem is, we all have this innate misconception that there's a real, true individual inside that body and mind. Unchanging individual who exists in his or her own right. We have that innate appearance and conception regarding others and ourselves. So as we learn a person's name, then we relate that name to our belief that there's a real individual character inside that body and mind. And we believe that to be true. And then there are individual characters which we please us, we like them. Which displease us, we dislike them. So here is the scientific no-no, subjectivity intruding upon our experience. I like, I don't like, I don't care. You know, strangers. This discrimination of others. And then we relate to them according to how we discriminate. Is good, bad, or indifferent. Believing that the goodness, badness, and indifference comes from their side. Not coming from us. It's from their side. Oh, that's a good person. That's a bad person. We don't believe that we, our mind is the creator of good and bad and indifferent people. So we behave according to our subjective distortion of reality. We also believe that I am an inherently existing me. And usually we cherish ourselves as more important than others, individuals. And that gets us into trouble. This self-obsession. I want, I don't want, I don't care. And that's why we discriminate others according to whether they're nice to us, not nice to us, or neutral. Friend, enemy, stranger. So, the merely labelled person, we do exist as persons, merely labelled persons. So, the merely labelled person that we are, it's correct when the teacher calls out our name and we put up our hand, I'm present, then that is a valid interaction. You are present in the class. Established or identified by your name. So, and everybody knows that the appearance of this face, this body, this sound of this voice is suitable to bear our name. Mistakenly, we think there is the person inside, which the name indicates, the real, true, unchanging person. That's a mistake. But conventionally, we do exist as individuals. So this merely labelled person or individual exists neither separate from the body and mind, nor the same as the body and mind. We're not the same as our body. You know, before I met Buddhism, I worked at Panch, the hospital, Preston and Northcote Community Hospital, which no longer exists, unfortunately, because it was a great hospital. And there was a doctor I worked with, and he broke his leg during a skydiving accident. It wasn't a bad break, he was still able to do his duty in the wards with plaster and I remember he told me that he'd had an x-ray to check up on the healing of his fractured leg, and in the radiology department, he was given the still dripping wet x-ray, didn't have computers in those days, and he carried it to the orthopedic surgeon's outpatients department to check up how it's healing. And he told me that he could not look at it. You know, this image on the x-ray film, because this was me. You know, he'd seen so many x-rays of broken bones, but this was different. This was me, and he couldn't bring himself to look at it. At that stage I had become a Buddhist, and I remember being quite bemused by the fact that this intelligent person had such a hang-up with seeing the body as me, to the point where he couldn't look at an x-ray of his broken bone. What prevented him from just looking at it? Huge barrier in his mind. And we all carry this acute sensitivity of the real, true me inside this body of mine. What's going to happen to me when I die? I mean, as a medical student, I had the same attitude. I will never leave my body to the medical faculty, knowing what the students did in the dissecting room, which is not very respectful to the bodies we were cutting up, learning anatomy. So, the problem is that we see, our mind sees something more than what is actually there. We project something more than mere labelled. But each of us is just merely labelled. Now, we'll play games with little babies just learning to talk, and we mention the names of each person in the family and say, where's John, where's Mary, you know, where... And the baby points at the brother or sister or auntie or uncle, and everybody smiles. Yes, yes, you're right. There's Uncle John. But just as the baby believes that, oh no, it's not just the face of that man sitting in the chair or the body, but that the real Uncle John is inside that body, the real person. And the baby believes it, and we believe it too, that of course John is not just a label, it is a real individual inside that body and mind, right? The Uncle John. There is no such thing as a real you or a real me existing in our own right inside here, completely empty of being what we think we are. And this is the crucial point in self-grasping ignorance. There appears to be a real true me from imprints from past lives. There appears to be a real true me, real true others, more than just the body and mind, the possessor of the body and mind. And we assent to that appearance, of course. That is the fundamental mistake. That is self-grasping ignorance. We're all empty of being what we think we are. The colours that we distinguish as good colour, bad colour, is empty of being good or bad colour. They're the goodness or badness that we associate with a particular colour comes from our side, not from the side of the object. So, you can read what's there, but at the bottom of that second page, disturbing emotions. Now, this is how disturbing emotions develop. This is referring to the unfortunate side of self-consciousness. Right? First of all, due to the innate mental imprints of ignorance, all objects of awareness... Right, that means all objects of mind appear to the mind as if they exist inherently or in their own right. So is this appearance is innate. It occurs in the mind of a fetus when it thinks I, in the mind of babies, of adults, at all times, in animals, birds, insects, there's the appearance to the mind as if the object exists inherently. Secondly, upon that appearance, whether it's to the sense consciousnesses or the appearance to mental consciousness, you know, our thoughts, ideas, memories, then after that initial appearance, there is conceptual mental awareness holding that appearance to be true. Now, this is the actual self-grasping ignorance. The false appearance is there all the time, and then grasping that appearance to be true is self-grasping ignorance. It's ignorance because the self of person or the self of the table and, you know, the clock, whatever, does not exist in the way it appears to mind. Therefore, it is not correct knowledge. It is incorrect. It is ignorance. Self-grasping, because our mind grasps or holds that false appearance to be true. Then the next step in the sequence of developing disturbing emotions is what's called improper mental engagement. That's sort of an English translation of a Tibetan term, which refers to our mind after the initial appearance of an inherently existing self or other. It exaggerates or superimposes good or bad qualities onto pleasing and displeasing objects seen as inherently existent. So improper mental engagement. Whatever is pleasant, and there's lots of pleasing things to the senses, to thought, pleasing thoughts, pleasing experiences, then the mind engages in an improper or a mistake. It enhances the beauty. It enhances the attractiveness of the pleasing object. It superimposes more goodness, you know, goodness from our subjective discrimination, that is what is actually there. And when there are bad experiences, unpleasant experiences, sensory or mental thoughts, our mind exaggerates the negative qualities, the bad qualities, or superimposes non-existent negative qualities on the object. So it is seen as our mind perceives it worse than it actually is. This is improper mental engagement. We see a group of people, our eyes automatically go to friends alike and non-friends or enemies dislike. Even we hear the name of somebody we don't like, that name is ugly. We would never call our children the name of somebody we dislike, but often we call our children the name of somebody we do like. Trouble is, we can change, can't we? Then the strangers who don't appear as friends or non-friends, our mind dismisses their relevance for me. We ignore them. That's improper mental engagement. Now, the fourth step, through believing these subjectively exaggerated qualities to exist upon an inherently existing object, which doesn't inherently exist, but we believe all of it exists out there on the person or on me, and we think of our own self, independent of our subjective mind. It's coming from their side, not from my side. And so, when there's a pleasing object, our mind exaggerates its importance for my happiness. We have attachment. We do not want to separate from it. We cling to it. We bond with that person or that object, that type of car or that football team. Mine. Our ego incorporates it into our sense of self. This is part of me. And then when there's an unpleasing object, then we see it with aversion, with dislike, and we believe our projected negative qualities to exist on the object, and so we push it away. We want to separate it. We can have just be irritated. We can be angry. We can have hatred. We can be murderous. There's plenty of examples. Road rage. Somebody delays us for a few seconds. That driver is bad. I hate. We can crash our beautiful new car into their car. We can get out a gun and shoot them. We can do the most insane actions in a split second because of being delayed a few moments heading towards our destination. This is reality. Because we see that other driver as being totally bad, to be eliminated. Anger. And we've all got the seeds of anger. We've all got the seeds of hatred. We've all got the seeds of love, compassion, kindness. But we usually add water and sunshine to the disturbing emotions of longing, desire. We don't see much fault with longing, desire and attachment. We see a lot. Most of us can admit that anger is not such a good emotion. But admitting that is not necessarily the power to control our anger. How often the explosion comes. Yes, after a while we'll feel sorry and we express our apology. But, well, sometimes, not always, the damage has been done. Where did that anger come from? Not from that person. It came from our own mind. We can't control others' activities. Even the ones we're attached to, we can't guarantee that they'll stay near us. And in many cases, our attachment suffocates them. Because we see them as an extension of our ego, we start to manipulate them to conform to our idea of my partner, my friend, my son, my daughter, my this extension of me. And our mental insistence makes them feel suffocated. They want to back off a bit, give me space. But we don't do it. Then we get angry at them because they don't conform to our preconception of how my friend should be. And then anger starts to see them, superimposes negative qualities. And then they can't do anything right in our eyes because we can't see them doing anything right. Our own mind is painting this incorrect negative picture, even of close family, husband, wife, children, mother, father. So the fourth step is through self-cherishing, always seeing our own happiness and freedom from suffering as more important than others, self-cherishing ignorance. We engage in, you know, I say unethical behaviour, immoral behaviour, through attachment, through aversion, and their derivative emotions. Now this is the uncontrolled mind. This is the negative side of self-consciousness. Yeah. That certainly is an element of learning behavioural reactions to the world, definitely. That's the environmental influence. Also, there are the innate seeds of anger, and this what we're talking about is the very fundamental mechanism behind attachment and anger. That comes from our mind. So yeah, you're right. There are definitely environmental influences on our psyche, you know, and they may keep coming, but we can work on the fundamental misconception, the fundamental distortion of reality that comes from our side. That's the main thing. And even in the worst environmental situation, where our mind might not necessarily be influenced by anger in the people we live with, or it differs between different individuals, but there is an influence. Is that? Yeah. See, what we're trying to get at is, what can we do about it? We can't do very much at the moment to change other people's minds, to change other people's attitudes, their prejudice, their underlying misconceptions. But we can do everything about our own prejudice, our own self-centeredness, our own self-cherishing. Yes, because it is our own mind. We have, and knowledge overpowers ignorance. Love and compassion overpower selfishness, self-importance, self-centeredness. We need to train our mind in cherishing others and gradually diminish discriminating against others. But that can be done. And then, merely by subduing our own negative emotions and abiding in genuine concern for the welfare of others, that alone can help people's minds. It brings peace, not just to humans, but to animals as well. I don't know whether it's true. I've heard that bees will not sting you if you're not afraid of them, because fear generates is a type of anger, you know, aggression, pushing away, I don't like. And apparently bees can sense it, whether it's pheromones or whether they can read our minds. Might be possible. They won't sting. I haven't experimented with that, but I have experimented with dogs at the monastery in France. I set up the first Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Europe, in the south of France. And our building was along the river in the countryside, outside a small town. And there were houses between our property and the village. And every house had a vicious dog, as the French do. They keep big dogs. And I knew every house where there was a wild dog, not wild, but a dog who would always bark. It couldn't get out of the fence, but it would make a noise. And one evening, it was almost, probably almost dark, I was walking back from the village along the middle of the road. And I knew the houses where there was a noisy barking dog. And before I got there, I meditated on loving kindness and sent this from my heart, this nice peaceful energy to the dog in that house. And I tell you, I ran the gauntlet. I got to the end of the row of houses and not one dog barked. I couldn't believe it. Even though it was an experiment, it worked. Well, probably worked. So, the point is that if we can subdue our mind, if we can be genuinely, and it doesn't take effort, just to have affection for others, kindness, and non-aggression, they'll pick it up. Whether it's body language or what, I don't know, but it is definitely possible. And so, just initially, this obviously can be such great benefit towards our family, our relationships at home, at work, in the street, and everywhere. And my father used to return home from the office, usually in a bad temper. And one time we heard a taxi pull up and father get out and come up into the up the drive, and he was grumbling about something. And all the kids were there, brothers and sisters and mother and me. And we're all hear the grumbling, and we were sort of, at least the kids were, hey, oh God, here we go. There's going to be arguments. And my mother said, here comes sunshine. And we're all packed up laughing. And that was her way of dealing. Here comes sunshine. And there was that, no matter what father said, our minds were totally changed. His being upset about whatever happened at work had no influence upon us. So, from our side, we should always be sunshine, okay? Genuinely sunshine. From mother's side, it was a joke, but it relieved the tension. Okay, so then there are six root we use the term affliction because it's like an illness. Anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, a mental illness. Because whenever these emotions manifest, they disturb the mind. They prevent our mind from being peaceful. So just briefly, you know, attachment. I took this definition from the book. It's a bit, anyway, it's a non-aversion to cyclic existence. Cyclic existence refers to the wheel of life. Dying, being reborn, dying, being reborn, again and then again and again, under the control of karma. So, in life in general, attachment is that emotion which clings to the exaggerated attractiveness of a contaminated object. Contaminated refers to something which has arisen from karma and disturbing emotions. That's, you know, that's everything in our lives, our ordinary objects. So, the objects of the external world. So, we exaggerate their attractiveness. We wish to possess and not separate from them. And this attachment, craving pleasure, actually results in suffering because it disturbs the mind. So even if we're with the person we love, then attachment is operating, is disturbing the relationship we have. We become jealous if anybody else looks at or talks to our partner. We become agitated if they don't fit the mould that we have superimposed upon them through attachment. Anything that they do or say which goes against what we want, we get upset. Attachment is already scared of separating or losing the object of attachment, whether it's a person or, you know, a possession, whatever it is. We can't enjoy that person. We can't enjoy the object because of attachment. Attachment is a source of suffering. It is not a source of happiness. Love and compassion a genuine concern for the welfare of another person, no strings attached. Just sincere joy at the happiness of another. So, love is not attachment. Our emotions alternate between destructive attachment and constructive love. The moments of love are not contaminated by ignorance. I mean, sure, we write poems, etc., and stories about love, 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 but what, and why? Why is there this emotional roller coaster about love? It's not about love. The downs are attachment, the ups are love. It's up to us to maintain the up and keep it steady and don't let it be influenced by attachment. So we've got to recognize attachment for what it is. And that's why I'm giving this information. Now it's up to you to recognize attachment in your mind. And anger is like, or hostility is the opposite. Now I remember, I spent a month listening to Lama Zofa Rinpoche talk about attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, and so on, the 8 worldly actions, week after week. My first course in Kathmandu, and decided I can't take this Buddhism, I've got to learn about it. So I went overland to England. And when I got to Istanbul, I went into the American Express office to pick up my mail. And there were some letters there for me. And then the lady behind the desk asked for some money to pick up my letters. And I was pretty keen on getting letters. This was the time before emails. And so I had to fork out the money. And money, because when you're on the road, you watch every penny. Anyway, I got angry at this lady, but I still had to pay for my letters. And as I was leaving the American Express office, the revolving glass doors, and so I went into them and I saw my reflection in the glass panel and the face was angry. And so I entered the revolving doors with anger and I came out of it laughing. And so, because I said to myself, that's anger. That's what Lama Zofa was talking about in my own mind. And as I sat in the grass outside the office and read my letters, totally laughing, that's what he meant. That was checking out about anger in our own mind. All right. Pride is seeing one's own qualities, one's own self, as superior to others. Pride is an inflated opinion about self, with respect to our power and influence in society, our physical strength, our physical appearance, our wealth, our family background, our education, and so on. So, pride, the function of pride is to have no respect for others. It's to belittle others and see oneself as superior. Pride makes the mind agitated and unhappy. You know, we're Australians, we love to cut down tall poppies. You know, well, I won't go to the psychology of why we do that, but we understand. We can see somebody who's aloof and superior considers themselves superior to others, and we love to pull the rug from beneath their feet and bring them down to earth where we are, as long as we don't get proud that we've done it. Ignorance is what we've been talking about. Doubt. Doubt is when the mind is wavering between a correct conclusion and an incorrect conclusion. And we're not sure. You know, all that Gass has been saying today, you should have doubt. But if you think, maybe he's right, and you check up, that's doubt leading towards the correct conclusion. And I say without proud that it is the correct conclusion. But if you have the doubt, thinking, oh, I don't know if he's right, but I think he's wrong, then that will be deluded doubt. And if you have that doubt, you won't check up. And that you might as well go home now. You've got to check up. So the doubt leading to the correct conclusion is what the Buddha said you must cultivate. You must question the validity of what I say and check up in your own experience. But if you dismiss it, you're not sure, but you, then you'll get nowhere. So deluded doubt is the one here, the one leading the wrong conclusion. And then that leads to the sixth disturbing emotion, afflicted views. So a view is a belief. And we can have correct beliefs and we can have incorrect beliefs. Afflicted views, obviously, are incorrect beliefs. So just briefly, they're listed here, and you can read. The view of the perishable group. Perishable group refers to the body and mind. They're perishable. The body and mind are constantly changing. They you know, moment to moment. And of course, they're all heading towards death, where they totally separate. So, the I, me, and my body, mine refers to my body, then this view holds the I, which is merely labelled upon the body and mind, to exist intrinsically or inherently, to exist in its own right. So you see, this view, it views the merely labelled I, which exists, labelled on this body and mind. But it apprehends the mere I, which exists, to exist in its own right from its own side. So what appears is correct, the merely labelled I, but what we understand when we think me or I is the real true me in here somewhere, the one that I love so much, or the one that is attacked by the bad words of another. You know, what do they say? Sticks and stones break my bones, but names will never hurt me. But if somebody insults us, whether it's in the schoolyard or in the office or at home, what is hurt? The names can't hurt. It is the clinging to this perfect true me, this innocent I, which exists in my own right, which we cling to strongly. But that is psychological. There is no object to cling to. It is a falsely projected I. So this first one is that problem. It regards the body and mind to be a truly existing self or the possessions of a truly existing self. Oh, the others, look, they're important, but you can read about them and they'll speak for themselves, unless you've got questions. So what I want to get is onto the positive aspect of self-consciousness. That's the second part. So, self-confidence, the positive side. So I've talked about the need to practice and train our mind in wisdom and compassion. And so the basis of actually training our mind in wisdom and compassion is enthusiasm to do it and perseverance when things are not going so well, not going so easily. We need to persevere with what we have embarked upon, training this mind in wisdom and compassion. So that combination of enthusiasm and determination, perseverance, That is the source of attainment of wisdom and compassion. We don't have that. I mean, every sports coach tells the team, each individual, you've got to persevere. You've got to have enthusiasm. You identify with this role. You are a champion. Do it. You know, the coach's pep talk. Same with the spiritual power. Why do we need enthusiastic perseverance? Because whenever we embarked upon anything, we're talking just a worldly job that we have to do or whatever, or a spiritual job, the problem is laziness. And that we have to overcome that. And we've all got the three types of laziness. The first is the laziness of being attached to mundane, pleasure-seeking activities, entertainments, food, sport, and so on. We don't train our mind in wisdom and compassion because we're too busy going to this show, going to that game, eating this food. You know, the whole focus of the week can be the restaurant. Friday, Saturday night, we're going to this fantastic food, etc., etc. Mundane, it's just enhancing attachment. And sport is enhancing both attachment and aversion, whether you win or lose. My poor father, I keep bringing him up. He was a fanatical St Kilda supporter. And it's not easy to be a St Kilda supporter, I tell you. Sometimes I say that, well, no, it doesn't matter. So we are attached and we get emotionally worked up through that laziness. We don't train our mind in wisdom and compassion. The second type of laziness is procrastination. Even though we understand the need to work on our minds and practice wisdom and compassion, and even we have the desire to train our mind in wisdom and compassion, we don't have the energy. And so we put it off. We think, oh, I just can't do it. I'll do it next week or next month. And we keep procrastinating and putting it off. We know it should be done. We get too caught up in everyday life. And finally, there's a laziness of belittling ourselves. We want to do practice in wisdom and compassion. We don't procrastinate, but we become discouraged by thinking, I'm too stupid, or this is for noble, intelligent people. I can't do it. And so that attitude prevents us from engaging enthusiastically through perseverance in training our mind in wisdom and compassion. So we have to recognize and overcome those obstacles. Now there are four aids, things which help us in practicing or training our mind and wisdom and compassion. There's a book written by a great Indian scholar and practitioner and monk. His name was Shantideva, and he wrote A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. There are many editions. This is one of the first translations, which Lama Zopa Rinpoche told me I should take it everywhere I go for the rest of my life. It should never be separated. And read it. Not just carry it, but read it. Anyway, in the seventh chapter, among other things, he presents these four powers, or four aids, to maintaining enthusiastic perseverance in training the mind. So, the first is the power of aspiration. So this means, as aspiration here, is an affinity for the wholesome goal, you know, for wisdom and compassion to achieve it, and the desire to really actualize that in our mind. When we constantly reflect on cause and effect, so this, in Buddhist terms, this means hearing the teachings on karma, on karmic cause and effect, and seeing how it relates to our everyday life, this will generate the faith of conviction to maintain our aspiration to practice ethics. Remember, ethics is the foundation, or morality is the foundation of cultivating wisdom and compassion. So we have to work on the foundation, ethical conduct, morality. That means listening, gaining the knowledge of the meaning of karmic cause and effect, and then analytically checking up on the teachings on karmic cause and effect to see whether they're valid for our own experience. And that that took me. Before I even became a Buddhist, I had to go through that and determine that the teaching on karma and rebirth, which I met in my first course, was so beyond my scientific worldview that I had to put them aside. Definitely couldn't become a Buddhist without being convinced of karma and rebirth. But it was during that whole journey to London and back again and so on that I was reflecting all the time on cause and effect, watching people's emotions, watching what they said, what they did, and what reactions were there, and what I said and what I did, and what reactions came to me, like my angry face in the mirror of the glass door in Istanbul. All of these things constantly were a little pieces of the jigsaw of karma and rebirth which fit into place. And eventually to the point where I could incorporate them into my scientific worldview. And I happened to be in Bodh Gaya, at the place in India where the Buddha achieved enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree. That's where I made my decision to become a Buddhist. Not a monk, not yet, but a Buddhist. So, constant reflection on causality, especially the teaching on the Bodhisattva's path. So this whole book is about the Bodhisattva's way of life. How to practice, how to generate wisdom and compassion, how to train in wisdom and compassion. So, reflecting upon this information, then develops the sound grounding of consciously adopting a code of morality of non-harmfulness towards others and, as much as possible, benevolence towards others. And you can't go from ordinary self to a saint in one moment. It takes time. But embark on the journey knowingly, consciously. This is aspiration. I can do it. I'm going to do it before I die. And we don't know when death's coming. It would be terrible to waste this opportunity by not striving to benefit self and others now while we can. So that's the power of aspiration. Then there's the power of self-confidence or steadfastness. Strong self-esteem. We need strong self-esteem. Before I met the Lamas, I was working in another hospital near Preston, Larundel Psychiatric Hospital. Knew nothing about Buddhism. And I could see what was clear, obvious, it was an obvious statement, that mainly our role was to work on people's egos, to elevate them from no self-esteem, and you know, most were severe anxiety, depression, psychosis as well, completely flattened minds, unable to cope with society, very low self-esteem, And apart from all the drugs we prescribed, all the shock therapy that I applied under the direction of the psychiatrist, but I did it. trying to get as many done as I could before morning tea. It was pretty weird. I could see there was something wrong. We were building people's self-esteem up, their ego, to the point where we could just throw them back to where they came from. Back to the intolerable domestic social situation from which they came. We weren't really getting to the root of the problem. There was something wrong with ego. But there was they needed, of course. They couldn't function because of low self-esteem. No self-confidence. What was wrong about ego? I didn't know. I even went to a staff party. The group that I worked with in, you know, one particular ward, the psychiatrists and the nurses, the occupational therapists and everybody. It's a very social scene. A barbecue, you know, what we do as Australians. And so I wore a t-shirt which my friends and I had printed, Stripey printed them, in which there was a big mushroom, red with white spots, with a slogan. And this was the first time t-shirts had slogans. In the early 60s, t-shirts were plain, weren't they? No slogans. But my friend was a silk screen printer. And so the slogan we had was "Munch That Magic." And so I arrived at the barbecue and the psychiatrist, David Leonard was his name. He looked at my t-shirt and he said, "You wore that to be provocative, didn't you?" I said, "Very clever, the psychiatrist." We had a joke. And so I talked to him about the experience of magic mushrooms. And he said, "You're the first young person I've ever heard talking about the psychedelic experience who makes sense. That's because you've got a strong ego." And I took the making sense good, but strong ego as an insult. But I didn't know why. What was wrong with ego? Until I went to Nepal a year or so later and met Lama Yeshe Lama Zopa, who talked about the fault with ego. That, yes, ego is our self-image and it's our worldview, but the problem with the self-image is that we think we're something that we're not. We cling to this false image of a real true me existing in here. Get rid of that. You don't destroy the self. You don't destroy the ego. You see yourself for what you actually are. Merely labelled. A mere name. There's nothing to cling to. Nothing to protect. So often we put walls of protection. You know, what Freud called ego defence mechanisms. In our behaviour and our psychology. To protect this phantom. A phantom doesn't exist, but we believe it to exist.
It's interesting that you bring sort of both ends of the spectrum of that ego into your talk, because we always, you know, refer to that inflated ego rather than the undeveloped or under performing ego that you mentioned of the patients. I think it's interesting you bring that
imbalance
that doesn't happen very often.
Well, but from my understanding, ego includes our self-image as well as our worldview. There are correct things about a self-image and incorrect things. There are correct things about our worldview and incorrect things. Ultimately, that they use the term egolessness in Buddhism. That's wrong. What we need is to recognize and dissect out the incorrect things in our self-image and the incorrect things in our worldview, replace them with correct understanding. So in my view, a Buddha who has achieved the union of wisdom and compassion, this is a state of perfect ego. Ego is not a dirty word. That's what I've learned. And that's so important. Because if you don't have self-consciousness, how can you have self-confidence? What are you confident about? Your positive qualities. Recognize they exist. But don't be proud. Don't be protective. Acknowledge that you do have something which others don't have. That's not pride. That's not putting others down. You'd love others to have positive qualities. But they don't. You do, therefore you can do something which they, at the moment, are incapable of doing. And your reason for training your mind in wisdom and compassion is to be their mentor when they're ready to understand. And so you're going to bring them. If they're hungry, you give food. If they're homeless, you give protection. Whatever they need physically, you give because they can't provide themselves. Then you give information, right? Knowledge through your speech, through reading, and then you elevate that knowledge and show them how to train their mind, and most importantly, you practice as you preach. You become a role model that they can identify with and follow. So this is the power of self-confidence. I am going to do that for others.
In a romantic relationship,
Sorry, I'm going deaf.
In a romantic relationship, how healthy is that dynamic of one being the aware one and the other one being the hungry or needy one?
In a relationship?
In a romantic relationship.
I didn't quite, sorry.
In a marriage?
Yeah.
How healthy is that dynamic between two people?
Well, as I said to Lama Yeshe at a course in Dramana, Lama, I've become a Buddhist and I really want to practice Dharma, wisdom and compassion as much as I can in my life. And I see two ways of doing it. One is with a partner. We can practice and study and work together. And the other is as a monk. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And he said, "Yes, dear, you can do it with a partner. But it's very difficult, because instead of just one crazy mind, you've got two crazy minds, and then three or four crazy minds." So reluctantly I said, "Well, what's the advantage of being a monk?" Which was not my preferred option. He said, "You can practice 24 hours a day," which was my initial statement. I want to practice as much as I can. So he got me. But I still had to go away and do 3 months meditation and things. So does that answer the question? With a relationship, can be done, but boy, it's tricky. You've got two crazy minds. But can be done. And it's done more and more so. Now my close friend, or friends, Gary and Chrissy, you know, who I went to primary school with, and we met Buddhism together, and they were a couple from way back in the 60s, and a third member of our gang, who was the only one in a big gang of medical students and art students who didn't become a Buddhist, he played the role of devil's advocate. He said to Gary and Chrissy, and we were very close, he said, "Well, what's Buddhism done for you? You two, you're arguing like you always argue. what's Buddhism done? And Gary replied very skillfully, you only see the arguments that happen. You don't see the arguments that don't happen as a result of Buddhism. Nice reply. So is that what you're getting at? Because I'm afraid with age I'm going deaf. I can't hear much. Okay, and they are now the art directors of the stupa. But they live in Queensland. Hopefully they can come soon. Still around. So self-confidence, or steadfastness, you know, is resolution to complete a task without giving up. We may, ordinarily, we may begin things with enthusiasm, but as soon as a difficulty arises, we lose interest and look for something else. Now, this is in ordinary life. Before committing ourselves, we must determine whether it's possible for us to complete the task. If it's not possible, then leave it for now. If it is possible, then do it with the full intention to complete it. Because once the bad habit of giving up a wholesome task arises, this will adversely affect this and future lives. You know, it's the habit. We will be a person who gives up when it gets too difficult. To generate the power of resolve to complete a wholesome task, there are three types of self-confidence, or literally, virtuous pride. Right, so non-virtuous pride is the affliction of superiority, putting others down and considering oneself superior. Here, there is the attitude of, I can do it. Others cannot do it because of circumstances. But I can, therefore I will. So there's a self-confidence of action. I will attain this by myself. So this is mentally promising to complete the wholesome action of training in wisdom and compassion without relying on others to do it for us. Inner growth only comes from our own conscious actions. We can't grow internally in wisdom and compassion through the actions of others. We can't rely or lean upon others. We've got to do it ourselves because it's our very own mind that we're working with, and the obstacle that we're working against is also our very own mind. Only we have access to our mind. Even a Buddha cannot transform our mind from selfishness to wisdom and compassion. So we can do something that Buddhas can't do. We can transform our mind. Buddhas show us how, and the path, and they help on the way, but to actually do it is up to us. So this is a self-confidence of action. Then there's a self-confidence of ability. So this is practicing self-confidence without conceit. You know, I'm able, but no conceited attitude. I'm superior because I'm able. And there's two verses from Shantideva. Powerless, their minds disturbed by afflictions, people in this world are unable to even benefit themselves. You know, there's compassion there. They can't do it. Therefore, I shall do it for them, since unlike me, these beings are incapable. Even if others are doing menial tasks, why should I sit here doing nothing? Why should I not engage in that menial task? Right? I avoid those tasks because of self-importance. It would be best for me to have no such pride. So, self-confidence, virtuous pride overcomes the afflictive pride. Then there's a self-confidence to overcome the afflictions. which is a heroic attitude, seeing the disturbing emotions, the afflictions, as an enemy to overcome. Shantideva says, I will conquer everything, and nothing at all shall conquer me. I, a child of the lion-like conqueror, the Buddha, should remain self-confident in this way. Whoever has self-importance is destroyed by it. They're disturbed and they have no self-confidence. For those with self-confidence do not succumb to the power of the enemy, whereas the former are under the sway of the enemy, self-importance. So that self-importance, that is our enemy in our own mind, not out there. Then the power of joy is happily beginning wholesome actions and wishing them never to stop. Like a child wishing for pleasure, the bodhisattva's desire for the joy of following the path is unquenchable. We should train our mind to never be satisfied with small accomplishments. We shouldn't rest, you just speak, well, that's enough, I don't have to do it anymore. What next can I do? Samsaric, I mean, ordinary pleasures are like licking honey off a razor blade. Quite an illustration. Every pleasure that distracts us from positively training our mind, the entertainment, the sports, the food, you know, all the parties, all of the entertainments are pleasurable and they're the result of virtuous karma. But they all, because they're contaminated, we use that word contaminated before, they're derived from karma and afflictions. There is suffering inherent in every pleasure. Every relationship has a beginning and an end. The meeting of our partner in life is the cause of the end, the separation. Every birth leads to death. Every pleasant experience comes to an end. Overindulgence destroys our body. You can go on and on, talking about the deficiencies of worldly pleasure. St. Kilda never win a premiership. Except once, and that was in the middle of the 60s when anything could happen. Probably won't happen again. Yeah, there's all these indulgences. You know, the party's over. It's happening all the time. We pick ourselves up and we chase the elusive peace and happiness that we know is possible. So it's like licking honey off a razor blade. There is sweetness, but your tongue will be cut by the razor blade. That is inevitable.
What about a sound friendship or a sound relationship?
Well, what?
A sound friendship or a sound relationship?
A sound relationship.
Yeah, or a sound friendship. Just a,
One of the persons dies.
Yes.
One of the persons decides they no longer like you and they hate you. Sickness, separation, COVID. Yeah, COVID has separated. There are parents who haven't seen their child for 2 years, 3 years. Their baby. It's vulnerable. It's not going to last forever. You're going to get old. Your body's not going to be able to experience the pleasures that it can experience now. Alright.
But does that mean that you shouldn't do it? Does that mean that you shouldn't have those friendships? Of course it doesn't.
It depends upon the individual involved.
It's not attached to that.
Yeah, well, of course. Non-attachment is what we're talking about.
Okay. And appreciation, you know, appreciation of the world, appreciation of the beautiful day, it doesn't mean that you're attached to the beautiful day.
Well, people keep coming out here and say, oh, sunshine, it's a beautiful day. I say, rubbish. A beautiful day for me is black clouds, lightning, thunder and rain. Wonderful rain. That is, to me, the most beautiful day. Everything's relative. There was a disrobed monk who I knew very well, even from before I became ordained. And he just showed, married, lovely lady. And I met him many years later and he's saying how perfect the relationship was. Oh, it's just wonderful. And I thought he was exaggerating a bit. And I said, you haven't reached the razor blade yet? And he should have known what I was talking about. Finally, there's the power of rest. So when the body and mind approach exhaustion, it's necessary to rest and relax. Overexertion can lead to sadness. What people talk about, compassion burnout. And abandoning, and if we have that sadness, we'll give up that action. So we need to relentlessly pursue each higher objective, wisdom and compassion, but take those short breaks when necessary. Go out and enjoy the outside world. But the purpose is to recharge your energy to continue the most important practice. As Shanti Deva says, when my strength declines, I should leave whatever I'm doing in order to be able to continue with it later. Having done, a typo there. Having done something well, I should put it aside and with the wish to accomplish what will follow. So that's the power of rest. And the power of joy, the enthusiasm of engaging things, not reluctantly, but with great enthusiasm to achieve what one has recognized that one can achieve. So this sort of, what I hope to do today is to resolve, different ways of looking at self-consciousness. You know, there are the mistaken aspects in self-consciousness, but there's very important positive aspects of self-consciousness, and that is self-confidence. Which is gradually built up. We all know how children need to be given self-confidence. We don't withdraw praise because we're going to increase their self-grasping ignorance or they're going to gain self-cherishing. Children need praise. They need encouragement to overcome just the obstacles of everyday life. Everyone needs the positive mental aspect of I can do it, I'm not hopeless, and frequent encouragement. As adults, then we need to go beyond the self-importance, and the pride aspect, the badges, the symbols of glory, and the cups. In the display shop, I only got one award, playing football, most improved player, Glen Iris Football Club, 1962 or something. Silver tray, bloody useless. I was very happy putting it in the recycled collection bin. I don't need this. My only trophy. But really, I can't believe the tennis players, they're kissing the cups. They're so ugly, these cups, and they kiss them. What the hell's going on here? Even the champagne, they tip it over others. They don't drink it. Crazy world. So, but look, we all need encouragement. We need encouragement at every level. We don't withdraw love and compassion. When others are under the control of self-cherishing ignorance, and we shouldn't put them down, we should use our wisdom. This is where wisdom supports compassion. We say skillful things so that they can see, oh, this trophy really is just a bit of metal, you know. And we don't have to bash them in the head about self-confidence and self-cherishing, but wisdom very skillfully. Even, you know, we can let people want to do something which is a mistake, then with wisdom we can encourage them to do it, knowing that it's not going to work, but they will learn in it not working. It's much better to learn that way than say, no, that will never do, can't do that, no. Because they, oh, damn you, they'll do it anyway. but if, you know, many things we start don't work in life. And so wisdom in relating to our children, to our parents, to our siblings, our relatives, our friends at work, should always be not black and white, no, yes, but wisdom can be very skillful and get people, and always with the thought to help people learn the reality of life, learn that the objects of desire and attachment which society is pursuing relentlessly and often crazily don't ultimately bring the peace of mind that they're fundamentally seeking. So it's not don't enjoy pleasure, but be careful. And then, you know, the heart breaks when relationships do break up, which so often end tragically in life. You know, I mean, you know, very often the person we hate most in life is the person we loved most, unfortunately. And we kill each other. There is so much ongoing misery in people, families, individuals not being able to get on with each other. This is a major problem in society. And so wisdom, we need wisdom to guide the boat of compassion through our life and bring people who are drowning on board and then put them off somewhere safe and continue our voyage. This is how to live. And we all have the ability to live in that way. And I hope that, unfortunately I don't, I'm self-cherishing and only interested in growing flowers and things. But these are the words of, you know, Shantideva and the Lamas, and I hope this weekend that some of the words have resonated in your own experience, and that you can have the courage and determination to live better for yourselves and others. So thank you for coming. I will see. Yeah?
Thank you. And can I ask if you're planning to do perhaps some other talks or discussions on other occasions?
A retreat?
Maybe not. Is it a Saturday or a retreat? Or is there anything coming up that...
Not from my side. Oh. Andy's pushing me. But I'm resisting. I've got to look after my flowers. Yeah, nothing planned, but who knows? I had a lovely email 2 nights ago that Lama Ursel, who is the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe, wants to tour Australia at the end of the year. He is committed to go to New Zealand, and before COVID, I'd send him heaps of money to bring him to Australia, and then COVID interrupted everything, and the airlines took all that money. But he wants to come, and that made me very happy. So I really hope he does. And yeah, look, anything can happen. I'll do my best, but really, I'm just an ignorant person, self-cherishing. Thank you. See you again.